twin sisters from a prosperous eastern Washington wheat farming family. Now he hoped to provide his little brother with something like the safe and secure home they had both known before their mother had died and their grief-stricken father had fled north. When a porter helped Joe off the train in Nez Perce and set him down on the platform, though, he could barely remember Fred, and he knew not what to make of Thelma. He thought, in fact, that she was his mother, and ran to her and threw his arms around her legs. That fall, Harry Rance abruptly returned from Canada, bought a lot in Spokane, and began to construct a new house, trying to piece his life back together. Like his older son, he needed a wife to make the new house a home, and, like his son, he found just what he was looking for in the other La Follette twin. Thelma's sister, Tula, at 22, was a lovely, slender, elfin-faced girl with a whimsical pile of black curls and a fetching smile. Harry was 17 years her senior, but that was not about to stop him or her. The basis of Harry's attraction was obvious. The basis of Tula's was less so, and somewhat mysterious to her family. The elder Rance must have seemed a romantic figure to her. She had lived thus far in an isolated farmhouse surrounded by vast fields of wheat, with little to entertain her beyond the sound of the wind rustling the bone-dry stalks each autumn. Harry was tall and good-looking. He had a glint in his eye. He was relatively worldly. He was full of restless energy. He was abundantly creative in a mechanical sense. And most of all, he seemed to be a kind of visionary. Just by talking about them, he could make you see things off in the future, things nobody else had even thought of. Matters proceeded apace. Harry completed the house in Spokane. He and Tula slipped across the state line and married on the shores of Lake Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, in April 1921, to the great displeasure of Tula's parents. In a stroke, Tula became her twin sister's mother-in-law. For Joe, all this marrying meant another new home and another adjustment. He left Nez Perce and moved in with a father he hardly knew, and a young stepmother he knew not at all. For a time, it seemed as if something like normalcy was returning to his life. The house his father had built was spacious and well-lit and smelled sweetly of fresh-sawn wood. Out back there was a swing with a seat wide enough for him and his father and Tula to ride three at a time on warm summer nights. He could walk to school, cutting through a field where he would sometimes filch a ripe melon for an after-school snack. On some vacant land nearby, he would while away long summer days by digging elaborate underground tunnels, cool, dark subterranean retreats from Spokane's sometimes searing dry heat. And as the old house had been when his mother was alive, the new house was always filled with music. Harry had kept Nellie's most precious possession, her parlor grand piano, and he delighted in sitting at it with Joe, belting out popular tunes, as Joe gleefully sang along, "Ain't We Got Fun," or "Yakahoola Hickey Doola," or "Mighty Lack of Rose," or Harry's favorite, "Yes, We Have No Bananas." Tula considered the music that Harry and Joe enjoyed coarse. She was not particularly happy to have Nellie's piano in her house, and she disdained to join in. She was an accomplished violinist, far out of the ordinary, in fact, her talent so highly valued in her home that growing up, she had never had to do the dishes for fear that her fingers would be damaged by soap and water. She and her parents all harbored the conviction that someday she would play in a major orchestra, in New York or Los Angeles, perhaps, or even in Berlin or Vienna. Now, in the afternoons, when Joe was at school and Harry was at work, she practiced for hours on end, lovely classical pieces that rose and fell and floated out through the screened windows and drifted across the dusty, dry city of Spokane. In January 1922, Harry and Tula had their first child together, Harry Jr., and in April 1923, they had a second son, Mike. By the time Mike was born, though, family life had begun to fray in the Rance household. The age of the big dreamer was passing into history before Harry's eyes. Henry Ford had figured out how to manufacture his automobiles on a moving assembly line, and soon others were following suit. Mass production, cheap labor, and big capital were the watchwords of the day now. Harry found himself on the cheap labor side of the equation. For the past year, he had been living and working weekdays at a gold mine in Idaho, then traveling 140 miles on twisting mountain roads home to Spokane each Friday in his long black four-door Franklin touring convertible, returning to Idaho again each Sunday afternoon. Harry was glad to have the work. It meant a steady income, and it made use of his mechanical skills. For Tula, though, the change meant long, dismal weeks alone in the house, with nobody to help out, nobody to talk to at night, nobody to sit down to dinner with except for three clamoring boys, an infant, a toddler, and a strangely guarded and watchful young stepson. Then, not long after Mike was born, during one of Harry's weekend visits, in the middle of a dark, moonless night, Joe suddenly awoke to the smell of smoke and the sound of flames crackling somewhere in the house. He snatched up the baby and grabbed Harry Jr. by the arm, yanking him out of bed and stumbling out of the house with his little half-brothers. A few moments later, his father and Tula also emerged from the house in singed nightshirts, bewildered, calling out for their children. When Harry saw that his family was intact, he dashed back into the smoke and flames. Several long minutes passed before he reappeared, silhouetted against the fire at the garage entrance to the house. He was pushing Nellie's piano, the only thing of hers he had left from their marriage. His sweat-slick face was a mask of anguish, his every muscle straining as he leaned into the big piano, moving it by brute strength inch by inch through the wide doorway. When the piano was finally out of harm's way, Harry Rance and his family gathered around it and watched, awestruck, as their house burned to the ground. Standing in the glare of the flickering light, as the last remnants of the roof tumbled into the fire, Tula Rance must have wondered why in God's name Harry had chosen an old piano as the one thing he would risk his life to save. Joe, now 9, standing by her side, felt again what he had first felt in his aunt's attic in Pennsylvania 5 years before, the same coldness, fear, and insecurity. Home, it was beginning to seem, was something you couldn't necessarily count on. With no place else to go, Harry Rance packed his family into his Franklin touring car and headed northeast to the mining camp where he had been working as a master mechanic for the past year. Founded in 1910 by a character named John M. Schnatterly, the mine was located in the far northern panhandle of Idaho, squarely on the Idaho-Montana border, where the Kootenay River flowed south out of British Columbia. Originally, the business had been named the Idaho Gold and Radium Mining Company after Schnatterly claimed to have found a vein of radium worth millions. When none materialized, the government ordered Schnatterly to stop calling it a radium mine. So he blithely renamed the concern the Idaho Gold and Ruby Mining Company, the rubies apparently being small garnets that were occasionally found among the mine's tailings. By the early 20s, the mine still had not produced much, if anything, in the way of gold, or rubies, or even garnets, for that matter. That, however, did not keep Schnatterly from importing a steady stream of well-heeled Eastern investors, feting them on his luxury yacht as he transported them up the Kootenay to his mining camp, and ultimately bilking them out of millions of investment dollars. Along the way, he alienated more than a few people, managed to get into 3 gunfights, and collected 3 gunshot wounds for his efforts, before finally dying a fiery death when an explosion rocked his yacht. Nobody could say for sure whether it was an accident or revenge, but it had the smell of the latter. Virtually all of the company's 36 employees and their families lived in Schnatterly's mining camp, Boulder City. Its various ramshackle buildings, 35 small, identical, rough-hewn cabins with attached outhouses, a blacksmith shop, a machine shop, a bunkhouse for single men, a church, a water-powered sawmill, and a modest homemade hydroelectric plant, clung to the mountainside along Boulder Creek, linked together by a network of wooden sidewalks. A one-room schoolhouse, sided with cedar shingles, stood among pines on a flat piece of land above the camp, but there were few children, and the school was sparsely and irregularly attended. A rutted dirt wagon road plunged from the schoolhouse down the mountainside through a long series of tortuous switchbacks, before straightening out and crossing a bridge over the Kootenay to the Montana side of the river, where stood the company store and a cook shack. It was a dismal settlement, but to Harry, it was a tinkerer's paradise and the perfect place to try to forget Spokane. With his prodigious mechanical aptitude, he happily set about repairing and maintaining the water-driven sawmill, an electrically driven rock-crushing plant, a 45-ton Marion steam shovel, and the mine's many assorted vehicles and odd pieces of machinery. For 9-year-old Joe, Boulder City offered an astounding cornucopia of delights. When his father operated the huge steam shovel, Joe perched happily on the rear end of the machine and took merry-go-round rides as Harry spun the steam-belching behemoth around and around. When Joe tired of this, Harry spent a long evening in the company shop constructing a go-kart. The next afternoon, Joe laboriously dragged it all the way up the wagon road to the top of the mountain, pointed the contraption downhill, climbed in, and released the brake. He raced down the road at breakneck speed, careening around the hairpin turns, whooping at the top of his lungs all the way to the river and across the bridge. Then he climbed out and began the long trek back to the top of the mountain and did it again and again, until it was finally too dark to see the road. Being in motion, outdoors, with wind in his face, made him feel alive. It brushed away the anxiety that, since his mother's death, had seemed to be nibbling continuously at the corners of his mind. When winter closed in and the mountainside was deep in powdery snow, his father got out the welding equipment and built Joe a sled, on which he could sluice down the wagon road at even more terrifying speeds. And eventually Joe discovered that when no one was watching, he could take Harry Jr. up the mountain, help him into an ore car at the top of a rickety trestle that ran alongside Boulder Creek, give the car a shove, hop in himself, and again rattle down the mountain at terrifying speeds, with his little half-brother in front of him, shrieking in delight. When he wasn't hurtling down the mountain, helping out at the mill or attending the one-room school above the camp, Joe could explore the woods or climb among the 6,400-foot-tall mountains in the Kaniskew National Forest just to the west. He could hunt for deer antlers and other treasures in the woods, swim in the Kootenay, or tend the vegetable garden he nurtured on a small plot of ground inside the picket fence surrounding his family's cabin. For Tula, however, Boulder City was about as forlorn a place as could be found on earth. It was unbearably hot and dusty in the summer, wet and muddy in spring and fall, and filthy pretty much all year round. Winter brought the worst of it. Come December, bitterly cold air flowed down the Kootenay Valley from British Columbia, made its way through every crack and crevice in the walls of her flimsy cabin, and sliced through whatever layers of clothing or bedding she tried to take refuge in. She was still saddled with a screaming infant, a bored and complaining toddler, and a stepson whom, as he grew older and more difficult to control, she was starting to think of as an unwanted reminder of her husband's previous and all-too-precious marriage. It did not help that to pass the time Joe plucked incessantly at a ukulele, singing and whistling the campy tunes that he and his father enjoyed so much. Nor did it help that when Harry came home from work he often tracked grease and sawdust into the cabin. That came abruptly to an end one chilly mountain evening when Harry came trudging up the hill in his greasy overalls at the end of the day. When he entered the cabin, Tula took one look at him, shrieked, and pushed him back out through the front door. "Take those filthy things off, go down to the creek and wash yourself off," she commanded. Sheepishly, Harry sat down on a log, took off his boots, stripped down to a pair of white cotton long johns, and hobbled barefoot down a rocky trail toward Boulder Creek. From then on, regardless of temperature or time of year, Harry dutifully bathed in the creek and came into the house carrying his boots, with his overalls draped over his arm. Growing up, Tula had always been treasured by her family, not only for her beauty, which exceeded that of her twin, Thelma, by a wide margin, and for her extraordinary talent with the violin, but also for the refinement of her taste and the sensitivity of her nature. She was so exquisitely sensitive, in fact, that everyone in her family believed her to possess second sight, an idea that was dramatically reinforced when they read the newspaper on the morning of April 15, 1912. The night before, Tula had awakened suddenly, screaming about icebergs and a huge ship sinking and people calling out for help. Tula was educated and artistic and determined to seek finer things than a wheat farm had to offer. Now that she was marooned in Boulder City, her few social companions consisted of the ill-educated and hard-scrabble wives of sawyers and miners. Increasingly, she was painfully aware that she was about as far as she could imagine from any means of fulfilling her dream of sitting proudly front and center as first violin in a major symphony orchestra. She could hardly even practice. In the winter, her fingers were too cold to dance up and down the fingerboard. In the summer, they were so cracked and sore from the dry Idaho air that she could hardly hold the bow. Her violin mostly sat on a shelf these days, calling out to her, almost mocking her, as she washed endless piles of dishes and dirty diapers. This was the kind of thing her sister Thelma had been raised to do, not her. Yet Thelma now lived comfortably in a nice house in Seattle. The more she thought about the unfairness of it, the more tensions mounted in the cabin. Finally, one warm summer afternoon, those tensions boiled over. Tula was pregnant with her third child. She had spent much of the afternoon on her hands and knees, scrubbing the cabin's pinewood floor, and her back was throbbing with pain. As dinner time approached, she began the nightly routine of laboring over the hot wood stove, feeding kindling into the firebox, trying to get enough flame to draw a draft up the chimney. Smoke billowed out from under the cooktop and clawed at her eyes. When she finally got a fire going, she set about trying to cobble together an evening meal for Harry and the boys. Between her limited budget and the scant selection of foods available at the company store, it was hard to put a decent meal on the table every night. It was even harder to keep it on the table long enough for her children to eat a square meal. Joe was growing like a weed, and he inhaled food as fast as Tula could make it. She worried constantly that her own boys wouldn't get enough. She began shoving pans around on the stovetop angrily, trying to make room, not sure what she was going to cook. Then suddenly she heard a shout from outside the cabin, followed by a long, painful wailing sound. Little Mike's voice. Tula dropped a pot on the stove and bolted for the front door. Joe was outside, down on his hands and knees, tending his vegetable garden that afternoon. The garden was a kind of sanctuary for him, a place where he, not Tula, was in charge, and it was a source of enormous pride. When he brought a basket of fresh tomatoes or an armful of sweet corn into the cabin, and then saw them on the dinner table that night, it made him feel that he was making a contribution to the family, helping Tula, maybe making up for whatever he might have done most recently to annoy her. Working his way down a row in the garden that afternoon, pulling weeds, he had turned around to find 18-month-old Mike following him, imitating him, happily plucking half-grown carrots out of the ground. Joe turned and bellowed at him in rage, and Mike unleashed a heart-rending scream. A moment later, Joe looked up at the porch and saw Tula, red-faced and seething. She ran down the steps, snatched Mike up from the ground, whisked him into the cabin, and slammed the door behind her. When Harry came home from work later that evening, Tula was waiting for him in the doorway. She demanded that Harry take Joe out back, out of her sight, and give him a good hiding. Instead, Harry merely took Joe upstairs, sat him down, and gave him a good talking to. Tula exploded in the face of what she saw as lax discipline. Feeling trapped, growing desperate, she finally declared that she would not live under the same roof with Joe, that it was him or her, that Joe had to move out if she were to stay in such a godforsaken place. Harry could not calm her down, and he could not abide the thought of losing a second wife, certainly not one as lovely as Tula. He went back upstairs and told his son that he would have to move out of the house. Joe was 10. Early the next morning, his father led him up the wagon road to the shingle-sided schoolhouse at the top of the hill. He left Joe sitting outside on the steps and went in to talk to the male schoolteacher. Joe sat and waited in the morning sunlight, drawing circles in the dust with a stick and staring morosely at a Steller's jay that had perched on a nearby branch and begun screeching at him as if scolding him. After a long while, his father and the teacher emerged from the schoolhouse and shook hands. They had struck a deal. In return for a place to sleep in the building, Joe was to chop enough kindling and split enough wood to keep the school's huge stone fireplace stoked day and night. So began Joe's life in exile. Tula would no longer cook for him. So every morning before school, and again every evening, he trudged down the wagon road to the cookhouse at the bottom of the mountain to work for the company cook, Mother Cleveland, in exchange for breakfast and dinner. His job was to carry heavy trays of food, plates heaped high with hot cakes and bacon in the morning and with slabs of meat and steaming potatoes in the evenings, from the cookhouse to the adjoining dining hall, where miners and sawyers in dirty coveralls sat at long tables covered with white butcher paper, talking loudly and eating ravenously. As the men finished their meals, Joe hauled their dirty dishes back to the cookhouse. In the evenings, he trudged back up the mountain to the schoolhouse to chop more wood, do his schoolwork, and sleep as best he could. He fed himself and made his way, but his world had grown dark, narrow, and lonely. There were no boys his age whom he could befriend in the camp. His closest companions, his only companions since moving to Boulder City, had always been his father and Harry Jr. Now, living in the schoolhouse, he pined for the times when the three of them had formed a kind of confederation of resistance to Tula's increasing sourness, sneaking out behind the cabin to toss a ball around among the pine trees, or to roughhouse in the dust, or sitting at the piano pounding out their favorite songs whenever she was safely out of earshot. Even more, he missed the times he'd spent alone with his father, sitting and playing gin rummy at the kitchen table while Tula practiced on her violin, or poking around under the hood of the Franklin, tightening and adjusting all the parts of the engine as his father explained the purpose and function of each of them. Most of all, he missed the times he and his father would sit out at night on the cabin's porch and stare up into the astonishing swirls of stars shimmering in the black vault of the Idaho night sky, saying nothing, just being together, breathing in the cold air, waiting for a falling star to wish upon. "Keep on watching," his father would say. "Keep your eyes peeled. You never know when one is going to fall. The only time you don't see them is when you stop watching for them." Joe missed that something terrible. Sitting alone on the schoolhouse steps at night and watching the sky alone just didn't seem the same. Joe grew rapidly that summer, mostly vertically. Though the treks up and down the mountain quickly built up muscle mass in his legs and thighs, and the constant swinging of an axe at the schoolhouse and the hoisting of trays in the cookhouse began to sculpt his upper body, he ate ravenously at Mother Cleveland's table. Yet he still always seemed to be hungry for more, and food was seldom far from his thoughts. One autumn day, the schoolteacher took Joe and the rest of his students on a natural history field trip into the woods. He led them to an old rotten stump on which a large white fungus was growing, a rounded, convoluted mass of creamy folds and wrinkles. The teacher plucked the fungus off the stump, held it aloft, and proclaimed it a cauliflower mushroom, Sporacis radicata. Not only was it edible, the teacher exclaimed, but it was delicious when stewed slowly. The revelation that one could find free food just sitting on a stump in the woods landed on Joe like a thunderbolt. That night he lay in his bunk in the schoolhouse, staring into the dark rafters above, thinking. There seemed to be more than a schoolroom science lesson in the discovery of the fungus. If you simply kept your eyes open, it seemed, you just might find something valuable in the most unlikely of places. The trick was to recognize a good thing when you saw it, no matter how odd or worthless it might at first appear, no matter who else might just walk away and leave it behind. Chapter 3 Every good rowing coach, in his own way, imparts to his men the kind of self-discipline required to achieve the ultimate from mind, heart, and body. Which is why most ex-oarsmen will tell you they learn more fundamentally important lessons in the racing shell than in the classroom. George Yeoman Pocock. Competitive rowing is an undertaking of extraordinary beauty preceded by brutal punishment. Unlike most sports, which draw primarily on particular muscle groups, rowing makes heavy and repeated use of virtually every muscle in the body, despite the fact that a rower, as Al Obrickson liked to put it, scrimmages on his posterior annex. And rowing makes these muscular demands not at odd intervals but in rapid sequence over a protracted period of time, repeatedly and without respite. On one occasion, after watching the Washington freshman practice, the Seattle Post-Intelligencer's Royal Brougham marveled at the relentlessness of the sport. "Nobody ever took time out in a boat race," he noted. "There's no place to stop and get a satisfying drink of water or a lung full of cool, invigorating air. You just keep your eyes glued on the red, perspiring neck of the fellow ahead of you and row until they tell you it's all over. Neighbor, it's no game for a softie." When you row, the major muscles in your arms, legs, and back, particularly the quadriceps, triceps, biceps, deltoids, latissimus dorsi, abdominals, hamstrings, and gluteal muscles, do most of the grunt work, propelling the boat forward against the unrelenting resistance of water and wind. At the same time, scores of smaller muscles in the neck, wrists, hands, and even feet continually fine-tune your efforts, holding the body in constant equipoise in order to maintain the exquisite balance necessary to keep a 24-inch wide vessel, roughly the width of a man's waist, on an even keel. The result of all this muscular effort, on both the larger scale and the smaller, is that your body burns calories and consumes oxygen at a rate that is unmatched in almost any other human endeavor. Physiologists, in fact, have calculated that rowing a 2,000-meter race, the Olympic standard, takes the same physiological toll as playing two basketball games back-to-back, and it exacts that toll in about 6 minutes. A well-conditioned oarsman or oarswoman competing at the highest levels must be able to take in and consume as much as 8 liters of oxygen per minute. An average male is capable of taking in roughly 4 to 5 liters at most. Pound for pound, Olympic oarsmen may take in and process as much oxygen as a thoroughbred racehorse. This extraordinary rate of oxygen intake is of only so much value, it should be noted. While 75 to 80% of the energy a rower produces in a 2,000-meter race is aerobic energy fueled by oxygen, races always begin and usually end with hard sprints. These sprints require levels of energy production that far exceed the body's capacity to produce aerobic energy, regardless of oxygen intake. Instead, the body must immediately produce anaerobic energy. This, in turn, produces large quantities of lactic acid, and that acid rapidly builds up in the tissue of the muscles. The consequence is that the muscles often begin to scream in agony almost from the outset of the race and continue screaming until the very end. And it's not only the muscles that scream. The skeletal system to which all those muscles are attached also undergoes tremendous strains and stresses. Without proper training and conditioning, and sometimes even with them, competitive rowers are apt to experience a wide variety of ills in the knees, hips, shoulders, elbows, ribs, neck, and above all, the spine. These injuries and complaints range from blisters to severe tendonitis, bursitis, slipped vertebrae, rotator cuff dysfunction, and stress fractures, particularly fractures of the ribs. The common denominator in all these conditions, whether in the lungs, the muscles, or the bones, is overwhelming pain. And that is perhaps the first and most fundamental thing that all novice oarsmen must learn about competitive rowing in the upper echelons of the sport, that pain is part and parcel of the deal. It's not a question of whether you will hurt or of how much you will hurt. It's a question of what you will do and how well you will do it while pain has her wanton way with you. All this soon became potently evident to Joe Rance and the other boys trying out for the University of Washington's freshman crew in the fall of 1933. Every afternoon, after classes, Joe made the long trek down to the shell house. He donned his jersey and shorts. He weighed in, a daily ritual. The weigh-ins were designed, on the one hand, to remind the boys that every extra ounce that went into the boat needed to be justified in terms of power produced, and, on the other hand, to make sure the boys weren't overtraining and dropping below their optimal weight. Joe checked a chalkboard to see which crew he was assigned to for the day, and then joined the crowd of boys gathered on the wooden ramp in front of the shell house to hear what Coach Bowles had to say before practice began. In those first weeks, Bowles' topic varied each day, depending on factors as unpredictable as the Seattle weather, or what particular infelicities of technique he had noticed in the previous practice. Joe soon noted that two larger and intertwined themes inevitably came up in these talks. The boys heard time and again that the course they had chosen to embark on was difficult almost beyond imagining, that both their bodies and their moral characters would be tested in the months ahead, that only a very few of them who possessed near superhuman physical endurance and mental toughness would prove good enough to wear a W on their chests, and that by Christmas break most of them would have given up, perhaps to play something less physically and intellectually demanding, like football. But Bowles sometimes spoke of life-transforming experiences. He held out the prospect of becoming part of something larger than themselves, of finding in themselves something they did not yet know they possessed, of growing from boyhood to manhood. At times he dropped his voice a bit and shifted his tone and cadence and talked of near mystical moments on the water, moments of pride, elation, and deep affection for one's fellow oarsmen, moments they would remember, cherish, and recount to their grandchildren when they were old men, moments even that would bring them nearer to God. Occasionally, as Bull spoke with them, the boys noticed a figure standing in the background watching quietly and listening intently. A man in his early 40s, tall, like nearly everyone on the boat ramp, he wore horn-rimmed spectacles, behind which lurked sharp, penetrating eyes. His forehead was high, and he sported an odd haircut. His dark, wavy hair was long on top, but cropped high over his ears and around behind his head, so his ears looked overlarge, and he seemed to be wearing a bowl atop his head. Almost invariably, he wore a carpenter's apron, covered with red sawdust and curls of cedar shavings. He spoke with a crisp British accent, an upper-crust accent, the kind of voice you might hear at Oxford or Cambridge. Many of the boys knew that his name was George Pocock, and that he built racing shells in the loft of their shell house, not just for Washington, but for rowing programs across the country. None of them, though, yet knew that much of what they had just heard Bowles say, the very heart and soul of it, had its origins in the quiet philosophy and deep musings of the Briton. George Yeoman Pocock was all but born with an oar in his hands. He came into the world at Kingston-upon-Thames on March 23, 1891, within sight of some of the finest rowing water in the world. He was descended from a long line of boat builders. His paternal grandfather had made his living handcrafting rowboats for the professional watermen who plied the Thames in London, providing water taxi and ferry services as their predecessors had done for centuries. Since early in the 18th century, the London watermen had also made a sport of racing their dories in impromptu competitions. They were rough-and-tumble events. The friends of competitors sometimes maneuvered large boats or barges into their opponents' paths, or positioned themselves on bridges over the race course in order to drop heavy stones into their opponents' boats as they passed underneath. Since 1715, the most skilled of the watermen had also held a much more genteel event, an annual race from London Bridge to Chelsea, in which the prize was the right to wear a spectacularly colourful and utterly British bit of regalia. A bright crimson coat with a silver badge, nearly the size of a dinner plate, sewn on the left arm, matching crimson knee breeches and white knee-high hosiery. To this day, the race, Doggett's coat and badge, is still rowed on the Thames each July amid much ceremony and grandeur. Pocock's maternal grandfather also worked in the boat-building trade, designing and constructing a wide variety of small craft, among them the Lady Alice, the custom-built sectional boat that Sir Henry Stanley used to search for Dr. David Livingstone in Central Africa in 1874. His uncle Bill had built the first keel-less shell in his boat-building shop under London Bridge. His father, Aaron, had taken up the trade as well, building racing shells for Eton College, where gentlemen's sons had been rowing competitively since the 1790s. And it was in Eton's ancient boathouse, just across the river from the looming eminence of Windsor Castle, that George had grown up. At the age of 15, he signed papers formally apprenticing himself to his father. And for the next 6 years, he worked side by side with him, laboring with hand tools to maintain and add to Eton's prodigious fleet of racing shells. But George didn't just build boats. He also learned to row them, and to row them very well. He carefully studied the rowing style of the Thames watermen, a style characterized by short but powerful strokes with a quick catch and a quick release, and adapted it to the purpose of racing in a shell. The style he developed soon proved to be in many ways superior to the traditional longer stroke taught at Eton. Messing about on the Thames after formal practice, the aristocratic Eton boys discovered that George and his brother Dick, although their social inferiors, could be counted on to leave them in their wakes time and again. It wasn't long before the Pocock boys found themselves giving informal rowing lessons to the likes of the young Anthony Eden, to Prince Prajatipak of Siam, and to Lord Grosvenor, son of the Duke of Westminster. George Pocock, in turn, learned something from the high-born Eton lads. He was inclined by nature to do whatever he attempted on the highest possible level, to master each and every tool he laid hands on in his father's shop, to learn how to row the most efficient stroke, to build the most elegant and best-performing racing shells possible. Now, feeling the sting of British class distinctions, pondering the difference between how he and his father spoke and how they were spoken to, he decided to put in the effort to learn to speak, not with his natural Cockney accent, but with the crisp, educated accent of the boys they served. And, to almost everyone's amazement, he did it. His crisp voice soon stood out in the boathouse, not as an affectation, but as a point of pride and a demonstration of his deep commitment to grace, precision, and what would turn out to be a lifelong pursuit of the ideal. Impressed by George's perseverance and by his ability on the water, Aaron Pocock entered him in a professional race, the Sportsman Handicap, at Putney-on-the-Thames when he was 17. He told his son he could build his own boat for the contest from scrap lumber in the Eton boathouse, and gave him some advice that George never forgot. No one will ask you how long it took to build. They will only ask who built it. So George took his time, carefully and meticulously handcrafting a single sculling shell from Norwegian pine and mahogany. At Putney, he slipped his boat into the water, leaned deep into his oars, and over the course of 3 heats, defeated a field of 58 oarsmen. He came home with a small fortune, £50 in prize money. Shortly thereafter, George's brother Dick one-upped him, winning the biggest of rowing prizes, the nearly 200-year-old Doggett's coat and badge itself. George was just going into training for his own shot at the Doggett's coat and badge, when, late in 1910, his father abruptly lost his job at Eton, discharged because he had developed a reputation for being too easy on the men who worked for him. Suddenly, without means, his father began casting around for boat-building work on the London waterfront. George and Dick, not wanting to be a burden on their father, abruptly decided to emigrate to Western Canada, where they had heard it was possible to make as much as £10 a week working in the woods. They packed their clothes and a few boat-building tools, used their winnings from their races to book passage and steerage to Halifax aboard the steamship Tunisian, and set sail from Liverpool. 2 weeks later, on March 11, 1911, after crossing Canada by rail, the Pococks arrived in Vancouver with $40 Canadian between them. Filthy, dazed, and hungry, they wandered on foot from the train station to Vancouver's brick downtown in a cold, dismal rain. It was George's 20th birthday. Dick was a year older. Set suddenly and unexpectedly adrift in the world, uncertain what they would do next, both were ill at ease in what seemed to them a primitive frontier town, utterly unlike the staid but comfortable environs of Eton. Though still in the king's dominions, they felt as if they had landed on another planet. They finally found a dingy room in a building downtown, rented it for $18 a week, and immediately went out looking for work. With only 2 weeks' rent money in their pockets, they tried their hands at whatever they could find. Dick worked as a carpenter at the local Bug House, a mental hospital in nearby Coquitlam. George went to work in a logging camp on the Adams River outside Vancouver, where he soon found himself scrambling madly up and down a mountain trying to satisfy a steam donkey's mechanically relentless appetite for firewood and water. After a month of frantically sawing wood and lugging tin pails of water up from the river two at a time, he quit and returned to Vancouver, where he got a relatively cushy job working in the shipyards, one in which he did not have to work quite at the pace of a steam engine. But it was grim, dangerous work that soon cost him two of his fingers. In 1912, things started looking up for the Pocock boys. The Vancouver Rowing Club, hearing of their reputation in England, commissioned them to build two single sculls for $100 apiece. The Pococks set up shop in an old derelict shed floating on timbers 50 yards offshore in Cole Harbor, and then finally resumed what would be their life's work, crafting fine racing shells. They set to work tirelessly in their shop downstairs, stopping only at night to sleep in an unheated room above the shop. Conditions were not ideal. Daylight showed through the roof, and wind and rain shuddered through wide gaps between the wallboards. To bathe, they had to dive out of their bedroom window and into the cold, salt chuck of the harbor. For drinking water, they had to row over to a public fountain in Stanley Park. From time to time, the shed slipped its anchor and drifted aimlessly among inbound and outbound ocean liners while the Pococks slept. At low tide, the shed sat on a sloping mud bank, listing 25 degrees from bow to stern. When the tide surged back in, the waterlogged timbers on which the structure was built weighed it down and held it fast to the mud. George later described the daily routine. The water would rise in the shop while we took refuge in the room above and tried to estimate when the next act of the drama would occur. Eventually, with a swish and a roar, the logs would break the mud's hold and up would come the building, like a surfacing submarine, with the water rushing out of the doors at each end. Then we could start working again, until the next change of tide. The brothers completed the work nonetheless, and as word of their craftsmanship spread across Canada, they began to get new commissions. By mid-1912, the two of them, just 20 and 21, were beginning to feel that they had their feet under them. One blustery gray day, George Pocock looked out the window of the floating workshop and saw a gangly and awkward man with a shock of reddish but graying hair, flying in the wind, rowing as if he were all elbows and knees. He flailed at his oars, George noted, like a bewildered crab. The fellow was apparently trying to reach them, though he seemed to be making little progress in that direction. The rowing was so awkward and ineffective, in fact, that the Pococks concluded the man must be drunk. Eventually they found a boat hook, snagged the man's boat, and dragged it alongside the workshop. When they warily helped him aboard, he grinned, stuck out a large hand, and boomed out, "My name is Hiram Conabare. I am the rowing coach at the University of Washington." Conabare, who would come to be called the father of Washington rowing, had become Washington's coach because nobody else was available to take the job, not because he knew the first thing about rowing. He had been a professional bicycle rider at a time when as many as 8 men might mount a single multi-seated bicycle and careen around rough dirt racetracks in wild melees that often ended in spectacular and bloody collisions. He had moved on to become an athletic trainer for collegiate football and track and field teams, and most recently the athletic trainer for the world champion Chicago White Sox in 1906. When he arrived at Washington in 1907 as coach of the track team and athletic trainer for the football team, his only rowing experience was 4 weeks in the summer of 1905 when he had trained on a 4-oared barge on Lake Chautauqua in New York. Nevertheless, in 1908 he stepped into the position of crew coach, more or less by default, replacing a pair of part-time volunteers. Conabare was, according to those who knew him well, simple, direct, and fearless. He attacked his new job with characteristic gusto, what George Pocock later called inflammable enthusiasm. Lacking a coach's launch, he ran up and down the shores of Lake Washington, yelling at his boys through his megaphone, freely mixing baseball slang with rowing terminology and a wide variety of exuberant profanity. He cussed so loudly, so frequently, and so colorfully, that offended lakeside residents soon began complaining to the university. Convinced that rowing instruction needed to be more scientific, he pored over anatomy books and physics texts. Then he appropriated a human skeleton from the biology lab, strapped it in a rowing seat, wired its hands to a broom handle, and carefully observed its movements as his student assistants manipulated it to simulate various rowing strokes. Once he was convinced that he was on the right track with the mechanics of the sport, he turned his focus to the boats themselves. Washington had relied on home-built shells, many of which were notably tubby and slow, some which had a tendency to fall apart when rowed hard, and one of which was so round-bottomed and prone to tip over that Homer Kirby, stroke oar of the 1908 crew, said if you wanted to keep her on an even keel, you had to part your hair in the middle and divide your chewing tobacco evenly between your cheeks. What Conabare wanted now was the kind of shells they made in England, long, sleek, elegant shells, fast shells. When he learned that a pair of English boat builders had taken up residence just to the north in Vancouver, he set out in search of them. When he found their floating shop in Cole Harbor, he told the Pococks that he planned to establish a veritable rowing navy. He needed to purchase a fleet, perhaps as many as 50, but certainly no fewer than 12, 8-oared shells. He wanted the Pococks to move down to Seattle forthwith, where he would provide them with a shop on campus, a dry shop on terra firma, in which to build the fleet. Stunned but delighted at the size of the potential order, the Pococks visited Seattle and then wired their father in England, telling him to make haste to Washington, as they had found work enough for the three of them. Only after Aaron was on his way across the Atlantic did George and Dick receive a sobering letter from Conybeare. He had spoken a bit prematurely, it seemed. He only had enough funds, it turned out, to buy one shell, not 12. When told of the setback, Aaron responded to his sons dryly, "You must remember that Mr. Conybeare is an American." Despite the radically lowered expectations, the Pococks were soon ensconced on the Washington campus, and Hiram Conybeare began to realize that he had hired much more than a skilled boat builder in George Pocock. When George began to watch the Washington oarsmen on the water, he quickly spotted inefficiencies and deficiencies in the mechanics of their stroke that no amount of fiddling with a skeleton could fix. At first he held his peace, not inclined by nature to offer unsolicited advice. But when Conybeare began to ask the Pococks for their opinion about his boys' rowing, George gradually spoke up. He began to teach Conybeare elements of the stroke that he had learned from Thames watermen in his boyhood and taught to the boys at Eton. Conybeare listened eagerly, learned quickly, and what came to be called the Conybeare stroke soon evolved from those discussions. It featured a shorter layback, a quicker catch, and a shorter but more powerful pull in the water. It left the oarsman sitting more upright at the end of the stroke, ready to slide forward and begin the next stroke more quickly and with less fuss and bother. It differed conspicuously from the rowing stroke long used by the Eastern schools and Eton, with its exaggerated layback and long recovery. And it began almost immediately to result in Washington's first significant victories. Before long, even the Eastern schools were taking note of the Conybeare stroke, trying to figure out how something so unorthodox could be so successful. Conybeare died just a few years later, in 1917, when he climbed too far out on a limb while reaching for a plum in a tree in his backyard and plunged headfirst to the ground. By then, however, Washington had become a serious contender in crew on the West Coast, a worthy opponent for Stanford in California and British Columbia, if not quite yet what Conybeare had dreamed of making the program, the Cornell of the Pacific. After the Great War, Dick Pocock moved east to build shells for Yale University, while George remained in Seattle, and orders for his exquisitely crafted shells began to pour in from around the country. Over the next several decades, a succession of Washington coaches and crews came to learn that the Englishmen quietly at work up in the loft of their shell house had much to teach them about rowing. They came to see him as something new under the sun, what in modern parlance might be termed a rowing geek. His understanding of the details of the sport, the physics of water, wood, and wind, the biomechanics of muscle and bone, was unmatched. But Pocock's influence didn't end with his command of the technical side of the sport. It really only began there. Over the years, he saw successive classes of oarsmen come and go, as he watched immensely powerful and proud boys strive to master the vexing subtleties of their sport, as he studied them and worked with them and counseled them and heard them declare their dreams and confess their shortcomings. George Pocock learned much about the hearts and souls of young men. He learned to see hope where a boy thought there was no hope, to see skill where skill was obscured by ego or by anxiety. He observed the fragility of confidence and the redemptive power of trust. He detected the strength of the gossamer threads of affection that sometimes grow between a pair of young men or among a boatload of them, striving honestly to do their best. And he came to understand how those almost mystical bonds of trust and affection, if nurtured correctly, might lift a crew above the ordinary sphere, transport it to a place where nine boys somehow became one thing, a thing that could not quite be defined, a thing that was so in tune with the water and the earth and the sky above that as they rowed, effort was replaced by ecstasy. It was a rare thing, a sacred thing, a thing devoutly to be hoped for. And in the years since coming to Washington, George Pocock had quietly become its high priest. Years later, a Washington coxswain would sum up the sentiment of hundreds of boys who felt his influence. In his presence, Washington crewmen always stood, for he symbolized that for which God's children always stand. Each day, after Tom Bowles finished talking and George Pocock made his way back up into his shop, the boys wrestled the long, white-bladed oars from their racks, carried them down to the water, and prepared to row. They were not remotely ready to step into the delicate confines of a racing shell, so they waited turns to board the school's venerable training barge, Old Nero. The vessel, a wide, flat-bottomed scow with a long walkway running down the middle and seats for 16 novice oarsmen, had served as an initial proving ground for freshmen since 1907, virtually the whole of the 30 years that Washington had maintained a crew program. As the freshmen of 1933 flailed at their oars in the first few days, Tom Bowles and Al Ulbrichtson strode up and down Old Nero's walkway in gray flannel suits and fedoras. Ulbrichtson mostly just watched the boys quietly, still sizing them up. Bowles, however, barked at them continuously. To grip their oar this way, not that. To square their blades to the water. To straighten their backs. To bend their knees. To straighten their knees. To pull harder one moment. To ease up another. It was bewildering and back-breaking. Old Nero was designed in part to drive boys who, by temperament, weren't cut out for crew, mollycoddles, Ulbrichtson called them, to an early realization of that fact before they could break expensive oars and racing shells. The boys strained and heaved and gasped for breath, but for all their efforts, they moved Old Nero only slowly and erratically out of the cut and onto the ruffled expanse of Lake Washington. As they tried to absorb their lessons and experience, and to synchronize their efforts, they lived in constant fear of making any of the many egregious errors Bowles kept pointing out to them. One error in particular required no scolding. They soon learned that if the blades of their oars entered the water too deeply, at the wrong angle, or out of time with the others, or if they remained in the water a fraction of a second too long at the end of a stroke, they were apt to catch a crab. The oar would suddenly and irretrievably become stuck in the water, immobilized as surely as if some sort of gargantuan crustacean had reached up from the depths and seized the blade, holding it fast. Old Nero would keep going, but the oar would not. The boy holding the oar would either be smacked hard in the chest and knocked out of his seat, or, if he held on to the oar too long, be catapulted unceremoniously into the water. Every stroke he took thus offered each boy the possibility of a wet, cold, and spectacularly public form of humiliation. Of the whole freshman lot, the only one who had ever rowed a lick in his life was Roger Morris. Before the Depression, the Morris family had maintained a small, rustic cabin on the western side of Bainbridge Island in the Puget Sound. As a boy, Roger had idled away his summers rowing lazily about in Manzanita Bay, a lovely blue cove lying in the lee of the Olympic Mountains. But he was tall and strong, and when he wished to, Roger could go pretty much as far as he wanted to in that rowboat, a fact he had demonstrated one day when he was 12. Suffering from a toothache and wanting to return to the comforts of his family home in Seattle's Fremont neighborhood, he rowed some 15 miles, north through Agate Passage, 6 miles southeast across the relatively open water of Puget Sound, among freighters and ferries, then east through the Ballard Locks, where he wedged his small rowboat in among salmon trawlers and tugboats and rafts of logs, and finally through Salmon Bay, before walking into the house to the utter astonishment of his mother. But aboard Old Nero, Roger quickly found that his freewheeling rowing style was more hindrance than help when it came to mastering the racing stroke that Tom Bowles and Al Ulbrichtson taught in the 1930s. None of the freshmen, in fact, found it easy to master it. To achieve even a reasonably smooth and powerful stroke, they had to learn to execute a series of precisely timed and carefully coordinated moves. Facing the stern of the boat, each boy began with his chest bent over his knees, his arms stretched out in front of him, and both hands gripping the handle of his one long oar. At the beginning of the stroke, the catch, he dropped the blade of his oar into the water and leaned his torso back hard toward the bow, keeping his back ramrod straight. As his shoulders came vertical over the center of his body, he began to drive by propelling his legs forward, his seat sliding toward the bow on greased runners beneath him. Simultaneously, he pulled the oar toward his chest against the resistance of the water, throwing all the strength of his combined arm, back, and leg muscles into the stroke. As the oar came to his chest, and with his back inclined about 15 degrees toward the bow, he reached the full extent of his layback. Then he began the release. He dropped his hands toward his waist and pulled the blade quickly and decisively from the water, while at the same time rolling the wrist of the hand nearest the water in order to feather the blade parallel to the surface of the water. Next, to begin the recovery, he rotated his shoulders forward and pushed his arms sternward against the oar while pulling his knees up toward his chest, thus propelling his body forward on the sliders back into the crouched position in which he had begun. Finally, as the boat moved forward beneath him, he again rotated the oar to bring the blade perpendicular to the surface for the next catch, dropped it cleanly back into the water at precisely the same moment as the other boys, and immediately repeated the entire procedure over and over again, at whatever rate the coxswain was calling for through the small megaphone strapped on his head. Done correctly, this process levered the boat forward in the water smoothly and powerfully. But it had to be done in one continuous and unbroken cycle of uncoiling and coiling the body. It had to be done rapidly, and it had to be done in precisely the same manner, at the same rate and with the same amount of applied power as everyone else in the boat was doing it. It was maddeningly difficult, as if 8 men standing on a floating log that threatened to roll over whenever they moved had to hit 8 golf balls at exactly the same moment, with exactly the same amount of force, directing the ball to exactly the same point on a green, and doing so over and over every 3 or 4 seconds. The workouts went on for 3 hours every afternoon, and as the days grew shorter, they stretched into the dark and increasingly chilly October evenings. By the time the boys came in off the water each night, their hands were blistered and bleeding, their arms and legs throbbed, their backs ached, and they were soaked through and through with a clammy mixture of sweat and lake water. They racked their oars, hung their rowing clothes up to dry in a steam-heated locker in the shell house, dressed, and began the long trudge back up the hill to campus. Each evening, Joe Rance noted with mounting satisfaction, there were fewer boys making the climb. And he noted something else. The first to drop out had been the boys with impeccably creased trousers and freshly polished Oxfords. At a time when images of successful oarsmen appeared on the covers of Life and the Saturday Evening Post, varsity crew had seemed to many of them to be a way to build up their social status, to become big men on campus. But they had not reckoned on the sport's extreme physical and psychological demands. As Joe made his way down to the shell house every afternoon, he saw more and more familiar boys, boys who had abandoned their boats, lounging on the grass in front of Suzzallo Library, casting him quick glances as he passed. The hurting was taking its toll, and that was just fine with Joe. Hurting was nothing new to him. Chapter 4. It is hard to make that boat go as fast as you want to. The enemy, of course, is resistance of the water, as you have to displace the amount of water equal to the weight of men and equipment. But that very water is what supports you, and that very enemy is your friend. So is life. The very problems you must overcome also support you and make you stronger in overcoming them. George Yeoman Pocock. On a stormy night in November 1924, Tula Rance went into labor in her cabin at the Gold and Ruby Mine. As she lay moaning in her bed, Harry set off for Bonner's Ferry, Idaho, 18 miles away on twisting mountain roads, to fetch a doctor. He promptly came to a washed-out bridge on the only road out of town. With help from some of the miners, he rebuilt the bridge, made it to Bonner's Ferry, and returned just in time for the doctor to deliver his first daughter, Rose. But it had taken all night. That was the last straw for Tula. She was done with the cabin, done with the mine, done with Idaho. A few weeks later, they packed up the Franklin, picked up Joe from the schoolhouse, drove to Seattle, and moved into the basement of Tula's parents' home on Alki Point. For the first time in a year, they all lived under one roof. It didn't go well. Tula, with yet another infant to tend to, was no happier in their cramped quarters in the basement than she had been in the cabin, Once again, Joe in particular seemed to be always underfoot. So when Harry got a job as a mechanic with the Hamahama Logging Company out on the Hood Canal, a half-day's journey west of Seattle by car and ferry, Joe had to leave too. Harry took his son, still 10, to live with a family named Schwartz near the logging camp.